Sanford wrote to her from their cabin in Darrington. "Hi, sweetheart. Sunday, Susan and I stood at the window in the airport waiting for you to look out of the plane, but you didn't." The letter went on to tell of meals at Ethel's, visits from Susan and Brad and Lonnie Ann. Brad and Lonnie Ann and their kids are sleeping out in the front yard in their new tent they bought. Your nasturtiums are all in bloom and are quite pretty. The hummingbirds were sure complaining about their feeder being empty, so I whipped up a batch and filled the jars. Boy, it sure is lonesome around here. The cabin is so quiet. I'll be glad when you get home. Well, Mama, it's 12:30 in the morning and I'm tired. So good night, sweet dreams, and I love you. Your old man. In other letters, Sanford wrote about pets, family, cooking, gardening, and how much he missed his wife. He kidded her that their living room looked like a warehouse for Lusier, the cosmetic line that Rosemary sold. If his plan was to reassure her that everything was normal at home, his letters were masterpieces of deceit. The only thing that seemed to trouble Sanford was his father. At the age of 48, he still had a prickly relationship with Dr. Paul Cunningham. He wrote about it to Rosie. "Friday, I came up to the cabin, but my dad had to complicate things for me. He called me at the office and wanted to have me drop off the air compressor for him. I told him I was going straight to the cabin after work. This didn't faze him at all. He wanted to use that compressor, so I had to go back home and help him load it on his pickup. I sure was unhappy about that." Paul Cunningham was the father who had kicked his first wife out of the house and farmed their son Sanford and Jimmy out for their whole childhood, and Sanford, at least, had never quite forgiven him. Otherwise, Sanford's letters were full of love and plans for a future with Rosie. "I know it's hard to understand how my father could do that, write such nice letters when he was planning to leave my mother," Susan said later. "But you have to understand that my father always prided himself on his letter writing. He always wrote long letters full of news. But most of all, the way he did it was the only way he could have left my mother. If she'd known, she would have feigned illness. She would have screamed and made scenes." For the 2 weeks in July and August of 1972 that Rosemary was in Alaska, Sanford wrote every third day or so. She had no inkling that her husband was not as lonely as he sounded. "I haven't seen anyone or called anyone. But there again," Sanford wrote, "you're the only one I want to talk to anyway, or at least be around. I really miss you, honey. I didn't think it would be this lonesome. I guess I love you so much, and you're so much of my life. I really am anxious for you to get home again so I can hold you in my arms and squeeze you till you holler." Rosemary came home from Alaska to a husband who was, apparently, devoted to her. But sometime later that year, Sanford told Brad that what he really wanted was to live with Mary. Brad thought that was a reasonable plan and offered to help his father defect from his marriage with a minimal loss of assets. Brad was 22 when he learned that his father was involved with another woman. He hated his mother so much that it probably gave him pleasure to know that his father was cheating on her. The two men talked over Rosemary's head using double entendres and winking, and she didn't have a clue. Although her marriage had been far from perfect, Rosie loved her husband. She was touched and amazed when Sanford bought her a new car, a Pontiac GTO. To top that off, he and Brad urged her to consider taking another vacation. She looked from one to the other in surprise. She had no idea that either her son or her husband cared whether she needed a vacation. "You've worked so hard, Mom," Brad said. "We think you deserve a vacation. Why don't you fly down and visit your sister Jewel in California?" Sanford urged. After a lot of coaxing, Rosemary agreed that it would be wonderful if she could take a trip like that. her husband and son, helped her pack and waved goodbye. She was gone for 2 weeks, and as soon as she had left, Sanford called his children and said, "You gotta come help me move." Susan would acknowledge that she helped pack. Her father was in such a panic to get out without a scene, it seemed the only way. She knew how bitterly her parents fought. They were never going to stay together. When Rosemary returned 2 weeks later, she was rested and anxious to get back to Sanford. But her homecoming was anything but happy. When she opened the front door of their house on 128th Street, she thought at first they had been robbed. Everything of any value was gone. The place had been ransacked, almost totally cleaned out. About the only objects left behind were her Indian things, stools with deer legs, old photos, dream catchers, a few linens, and some furniture that was almost worn out. That brutal trick was the way Rosemary found out about Sanford's new woman. Her husband had left her and taken everything they had bought for their home. And Brad, her own son, had helped him do it. Susan's part in the deception was minuscule, and Rosemary may not have known that she helped at all. Rosemary had not been the perfect wife, and certainly she was not a perfect mother. But the fact that Brad had plotted against her probably hurt her as much as losing her husband to another woman. The men in her life, the ones she had loved and looked to for protection, had betrayed her. She turned now to her nephew Gary, Jimmy's son. In her despair, Rosemary visited her nephew Gary and his wife for hours every day and wept and wailed about Sanford's infidelity. She begged Gary to spy on him and his new girlfriend. Maybe he could find out something she could use to get her husband back. Gary held her hand and commiserated with her, but he wasn't about to become a private eye. He knew that the break was final. "Brad, introduce that woman to Sanford," Rosemary sobbed, almost unbelieving. "That woman worked with Associated Grocers in Yakima, and I didn't know one thing about it." Sanford moved in with Mary, and in time they were married. He helped raise her daughter. In their divorce settlement, Sanford got the house on 128th Street, and Rosemary held title to their cabin in Darrington. She never planted nasturtiums there again, and eventually she transferred it back to Sanford. After that, it was a long, long time before Rosemary trusted anyone, and in the end, all the members of the Cunningham family would be completely estranged from one another. Some would be dead, others would not speak. And if Brad was full of guile and cruelty in his marriage to Lonnie Ann, he had an expert mentor in his father. Chapter 16. Much to Brad's disgust, Lonnie Ann had always maintained her friendship with his older sister Ethel. An assertive woman, somewhat garrulous and surprisingly strong given the experiences of her childhood, Ethel was one of the few women in Brad's life who were not afraid of him. In desperation, Lonnie Ann went to Ethel in September 1972 and confided that she had begged Brad for a divorce, but that at first he wouldn't even consider it. Then he had told her, "Fine, you want a divorce? Go for it. You'll never keep these kids. I'll get them. How dare you try to get away from me?" "Brad laid out a scenario for me," Lonnie Ann would say later. "He told me what would happen to me if I left him. He said that I was a slut. He said he could kill me in our apartment and make it look like a rape killing and that no one would ever suspect him." "I believed her," Ethel would confirm. "We moved her and the kids out of her apartment that night." "You have to understand," Lonnie Ann said, "that I got to a point with the relationship that I believed nothing worse could happen to me by going than by staying. I had become punch happy. I could never tell when he was going to be Dr. Jekyll and when he was going to be Mr. Hyde." Lonnie Ann had no friends who were in a position to help her, and there were no women's shelters to go to in the early 1970s. She was totally dependent on Brad, and he had always been the one who kept track of whatever money they had and who paid the bills. "I had no survival knowledge to exist on my own, but I had to," Lonnie Ann said. Surprisingly, Brad didn't put up much of a fight when she finally left him. He was finished with her anyway. Their divorce was final in May 1973, awarded to Lonnie Ann on her filing of cruel and unusual treatment. Initially, they had an agreement to share custody of Kate and Brent, although the children would live with their mother. Lonnie Ann moved to Oregon to attend college. She hoped eventually to graduate from Washington State and then go on to graduate school so that she could support herself and her children. At the moment, they had virtually no resources beyond what Brad was willing to send her, and even that she could never really count on. In 1974, however, Brad told her that he had changed his mind about letting her have Kate and Brent. She had been accepted at Washington State University in Pullman that summer, and Brad had shown no concern that she and the children would be moving 300 miles east of Seattle. "He waited until within 4 weeks of my scheduled move before trying for the court order," Lonnie Ann recalled. "He contended that he was not interfering with my attending the university. If I wanted to attend school, fine, the children could live with him. The court order was denied. Then he filed for custody a second time." Actually, Brad had never intended that Lonnie Ann should have Kate and Brent. He just needed some time to build a life in which he felt he would have a better chance of having the children awarded to him. When he had done that, he initiated legal action to gain full custody of his children. Even his own parents were never quite sure why. Lonnie Ann was a good mother, and Brad could be an impatient, punishing father. But Brad wanted his children, and the struggle to possess them, actually to repossess them, was, in Lonnie Ann's recall, desperate, emotional. Brad had warned her any number of times that if she ever left him, he would take the children from her. Still, he had let them go with her, and she had begun to hope cautiously that Brad's threat to fight her for the children had been empty. Now she realized he had only been biding his time. There was nothing he could do to her that would hurt her more than taking her children, and he knew it. Brad had married again, rapidly. He told associates that he felt he would have a much better chance of gaining full custody of Kate and Brent if he was a married man. Because he knew mothers were awarded custody more often than single fathers, Brad's second trip to the altar was probably nothing more than a marriage of convenience. His second wife, Cynthia Marasco, was 15 years older than he was and as different from Lonnie Ann as she could possibly be. A teacher, divorced after a long marriage to a wealthy attorney, Cynthia lived in a luxurious six-bedroom estate-like home in an upscale suburb of Seattle. She was a striking woman with black hair. One of Brad's sisters thought Cynthia resembled their mother, Rosemary, a great deal. Cynthia was over 40 and Brad was only 25, but he seemed older because his presence was larger than life and he was tremendously self-confident. At first glance, they did not appear to be the mismatched couple that they were. She was very attractive and looked younger, and he could have passed for a man in his 30s. Cynthia had three sons, of whom the youngest, Nicholas, was in grade school when she met Brad through their mutual interest in real estate ventures. Because she was so devoted to her own boys, she could empathize with Brad's passion to get his children back. He seemed utterly bereft without them. Brad told Cynthia he was worried sick about Lonnie Ann's complete disregard for Kate's and Brent's well-being. He said he had seen some small children playing alone in a park and had walked over to see if they were okay. "They were my own children," Brad moaned. "And Lonnie Ann's out there on the highway hitchhiking with them. Can you imagine the danger that puts them in? Cynthia was appalled. She already had the perfect home for raising children, and Brad had the prospects, she believed, for a splendid future in the business world. Together they could make a team that would help Brad regain custody of his children, and he would help her raise her three boys. Beyond that, she felt they would work well together in business. Beginning in March 1973, Cynthia lent Brad money every 2 or 3 months to help pay his child support and for investments. By January of 1974, he owed her almost $15,000. There are few women facing their 40s alone who would not have been dazzled by the attention Brad paid to Cynthia Marasco. After their wedding ceremony on June 4, 1974, which was legal if not lavish, Brad moved into Cynthia's lovely home. But the idyllic melding of families that Cynthia had pictured never materialized. Almost from the beginning, her own sons were resentful of this young man in his 20s who suddenly appeared in their lives, moved into their home, and started ordering them around. Brad wasn't that much older than Cynthia's oldest son, and he certainly wasn't a tactful, considerate father figure. He was impatient and mercurial. Cynthia did her best to make the marriage work. Brad had often talked about how much he liked to camp out and about his love for the Yakima area. Cynthia bought a Volkswagen camper and all the gear needed for outdoor trips. The few good times they had together were their camping trips. Unconsciously, perhaps, Brad was emulating the family he had grown up in. Rosie and Sanford's home life was marked by argument and punishment, but their times out camping were always happy and without strife. Now, when Brad appeared in custody hearings for Kate and Brent, he would have the advantage of being a married man living with his wife and three stepsons, while Lonnie Ann was a divorced woman and a student who lived in low-rent apartments, usually with another young woman so that she could make ends meet. And it was true that she had hitchhiked with her toddlers. Someone had poured sugar into her gas tank so she couldn't drive her car, and she had no choice but to hitchhike. Lonnie Ann could not afford an attorney for the custody battle, so she was represented by a lawyer from Legal Aid. Brad had his own attorney and clearly felt he would win. He had lined up his new wife, his father, and other witnesses prepared to give such cogent testimony against Lonnie Ann that he was sure it would convince the judge that he was the more competent parent. He was apparently doing very well in business, and he certainly dressed the part of a successful man. Rosemary Cunningham agonized over how she was going to testify. She loved her grandchildren, and she had been witness to Brad's vicious discipline of them when he brought them to family reunions. "When the children didn't want to eat something on their plates," she recalled privately, if not in court, "he would force them to eat it until they threw up on their plates." In the end, thinking of the children and pushing down her own fear of what Brad might do to her, Rosemary testified for her former daughter-in-law, saying she thought that Kate and Brent should be with Lonnie Ann. Sanford Cunningham equivocated. He said that he thought it was 6 of 1 and a half dozen of the other. He didn't think it mattered which parent had custody. Brad had lost one good witness he wanted, Susan, his younger sister. "I moved away from home when I was 16, and I hadn't even seen Brad for more than 5 years," she said. "I moved because we all always had to take sides against each other, and I refused to take sides." Now her father and brother wanted 20-year-old Susan to take sides once more. "Brad and Dad approached me and asked me to testify against my mother in Lonnie Ann's custody hearing. They wanted me to say that my mother was a homosexual." That, Brad and Sanford figured, would undermine Rosemary's testimony. Her father and brother had spent a whole day with Susan, saying how happy they were to see her, buying her lunch. But Susan knew what they wanted. They wanted her to help them destroy Lonnie Ann and her own mother in one fell swoop. Susan refused. I testified instead about the time that Brad beat Mom, Susan said, and I was out of the family from then on. When she chose to help Lonnie Ann, she ended, in essence, her own connection to the males in her family. Her father had always felt that money meant there was a reason to do something, and he apparently believed that money could also entice or punish. He used money for revenge against Susan for her betrayal. I was out of his will, she said. So was Ethel. He left us each $100, and everything else went to Brad. Lonnie Ann presented a very effective case. Despite Brad's continual attempts to convince her that she was stupid garbage who would be insane to think about going to college, she testified that she was doing quite well in her classes where she was studying physical education. She wanted to be a teacher or a coach. She admitted on the stand that it was difficult to get by. She had very little money. Yes, she usually had to split her rent with another woman or a family. Lonnie Ann had learned that Brad had tried to get to her housemates and have them testify against her. Her first roommate told her that Brad had offered to pay her to lie about Lonnie Ann during the custody hearing. She had refused. "I wanted you to know what he was planning," the woman said. Another woman with whom Lonnie Ann had lived just prior to the hearing moved out abruptly one day while Lonnie Ann was at school in Portland. She turned up again as a surprise witness for Brad in the custody hearing, and she wouldn't meet Lonnie Ann's eyes. But her testimony didn't mesh with the written affidavit she had given earlier, and she waffled under cross-examination. During a recess, an officer of the court overheard Brad berate Lonnie Ann's ex-roommate. "You didn't say what you agreed to say." The woman later admitted on the stand that she had lied about Lonnie Ann's competency as a mother. Suddenly, for the first time in a long time, the tide turned in Lonnie Ann's favor, and to Brad's utter amazement, she won their latest court skirmish. When the judge awarded custody of the children to Lonnie Ann, she glanced fearfully at Brad, wondering what he would do. She saw his face darken, the veins stand out on his neck, and a pulse beat fiercely at his temples. He was in the blackest rage she had ever seen, and she had seen many. After the judge left the bench and disappeared into his chambers, Brad toppled to the floor like a felled tree. It seemed at first that he had had a heart attack or a stroke, but he got to his feet in a few moments, apparently fully recovered. It may have been that he was so angry he had blacked out. Brad had never lost before, nor would he soon lose again. After Lonnie Ann won custody again in court, the original reason for Brad's marriage to Cynthia dissolved. He seemed totally uninterested in her now. She had also discovered that Lonnie Ann was nothing like the neglectful, promiscuous woman Brad had described to her. At that point, Cynthia just wanted out of her marriage, and she had to find a way to do it with as few repercussions as possible. Cynthia had finally come to the realization that her main attraction for Brad had been her house, her money, her stability. If she stayed with him, she might lose all three. Yet even though she could now see him in the clear light of day, she would always soft-pedal how bad things got. There were arguments over her boys, over money, over almost everything, it seemed. Brad broke Cynthia's collarbone, although many years later, Cynthia would downplay the violence in their marriage. "It wasn't his fault. It was mine. I pushed him, and he reacted." They separated on September 17, 1975, and Cynthia filed for divorce on November 26th. Brad moved into an apartment in Bellevue, and Cynthia didn't expect to see him again. But she would learn, unhappily, that no woman simply walked away from Brad Cunningham. In their divorce settlement, the division of property should have been simple. They had signed prenuptial agreements specifying that they would retain their individual assets as they were when they went into the marriage. Among other things, Cynthia had owned a yellow 1973 Volvo, which she had financed through a credit union. Of course, she had also paid for the 1973 Volkswagen camper. According to the prenuptial contract, they reverted to her. She also wanted him to repay the money she had lent him, plus accrued interest. By May of 1975, Brad and Cynthia were living apart, and she was again using the name Marasco. She had gone into the marriage with few stars in her eyes, hoping that love might grow with familiarity. She knew the marriage might not last, but she had never dreamed that she would be caught in a spider's web where she would come to fear Brad with his .38 Colt Detective Special and his awesome temper. All Cynthia wanted was to have her serenity back and to keep what she'd had before the marriage. She and her now teenage son Nicholas were going on with their lives. The older boys were grown and out of her home. She had her master's degree, and she could still teach school. But Cynthia would learn, just as Lonnie Ann had learned, that Brad was a man who felt betrayed if someone tried to rob him of what he considered his. Furthermore, he would prove to be a tremendously sore loser. Sometime after their separation, Cynthia and Nicholas had moved from the big house she once owned and were living in a luxurious apartment overlooking a private golf course when Brad slipped back into their lives. In an oddly childish show of power, he stole Cynthia's vehicles twice in one day. Cynthia had an appointment with her attorney on May 22, 1975, at his Bellevue office. At 6:45 that morning, she found that her Volvo was missing. She had no choice but to drive the Volkswagen camper. But when she left her lawyer's office, she found that the camper had disappeared too. She was pretty sure that her vehicles had not been random targets, and she thought she knew who had taken them. Brad. Cars were almost as important as children to Brad. Once he had them in his possession, he didn't like to let them go. Later, when he was much richer, he would own whole stables of Mercedes cars and usually some macho vehicle like a Unimag or a Humvee, plus a couple of motorcycles. In this case, Brad neither owned nor needed them, but he knew Cynthia would be terribly inconvenienced without the Volvo and the camper. In her police report, Cynthia named Bradley Cunningham, my estranged husband, as a possible suspect. She warned the King County police officers who took the report that Brad routinely carried a Colt 38. "All I want is to have my vehicles back," Cynthia said quietly. "I don't want to file charges." The officers saw that she was obviously afraid of her ex-husband. Informed that she was setting the judicial process in motion by filing a complaint, Cynthia finally acquiesced. She had precious little choice. If she didn't file the complaint, she feared she would never see the Volvo or the Volkswagen again. Later that May afternoon, Brad himself walked into the King County Police's South Precinct to report that his .38 pistol had been stolen. He was surprised and outraged when he was arrested and booked on two charges of grand larceny, auto. Faced with the very real probability of spending at least one night, and maybe more, in the King County Jail, Brad admitted that he had taken Cynthia's vehicles. It was a divorce thing, he explained, just the bad feelings and reprisals that happened in a lot of marriages. He was certainly no criminal, he said with a grin, and he would be glad to tell the officers where the stolen car and camper were. He said the Volvo was over in Bellevue, a half block from Cynthia's attorney's office. The Volkswagen camper was on the sixth floor of the parking garage of the Pacific building where his office was located. Detective Gary Trent of the Bellevue Police Department checked for the yellow Volvo and found it just where Brad said it would be. It was in perfect shape. Seattle police detectives went to the Pacific Building parking garage. The Volkswagen camper was parked there. However, the steering wheel was immobilized with a chain and lock. Brad had the key to the Volvo and the key to the locked steering wheel in his possession. He surrendered them easily enough, and the two vehicles were returned to Cynthia. The police looked upon the double auto theft more as a symptom of postmarital rancor than as felonies. They were annoyed that Brad Cunningham had made thoughtless, childish abuse of their time, but since neither vehicle had been damaged and Cynthia didn't want to push prosecution, the matter was apparently settled amicably. But the day was not over. At 5 that evening, Nicholas looked out the window of his apartment and saw his stepfather walk up to his mother's Volvo, unlock the driver's door, jump in, and drive the car away. Once again, Cynthia called the police, and once again she stressed that she didn't want to irritate Brad by pressing charges. She just wanted her Volvo back. Police located it at Brad's apartment, but it wouldn't start. He had removed both the coil and distributor cap wires. The officers drove Cynthia to a garage to buy the parts she needed to get her car going. It was annoying, certainly, but police had seen divorcing couples play far worse tricks on each other. One Washington State man had been so furious when his wife was awarded their home that he rented a bulldozer and systematically leveled the house and everything in it. In comparison, a day's spree of car hiding didn't seem that pathological. Human behavior rarely reveals itself all at once. Most people grow stronger in one area, weaker in others, perhaps more compulsive in still others. An old adage says that what we are when we are old is only a progression of what we have always been. If you were a mean kid, you will probably be a mean old man. Brad Cunningham had always had tremendous charm, intelligence, and business acumen, but long before he was 30, he had demonstrated decidedly negative aspects of his personality, particularly when it came to his relationships with women. 2 tries at matrimony revealed that he required an inordinate amount of control in a marriage and that he did not give up those things that he felt belonged to him easily. At his center, moreover, he seemed to have a mean streak snaking through everything he did and everything he was. He had tormented his cousins and smaller children from the time he was a boy. He had charmed, seduced, and walked away from teenage girls who idolized him. He had always appeared to consider women lesser humans, merely lowly females put on earth to help him achieve what he wanted, whether it was to climb higher in business or to become a father, whether he needed sexual satisfaction or, in the worst of circumstances, a punching bag. He was, of course, only 26, and there was the possibility that he was simply immature, given to temper tantrums and petty revenge. His mother hoped so. Despite the physical harm he had done to her, despite the way he had sided with his father and helped to betray her, Rosemary Cunningham still loved Brad. He was her only son. Lonnie Ann continued going to college and in 1978 graduated with a bachelor's degree in physical education. Brad paid child support for Kate and Brent only sporadically. By 1983, he ceased any contact at all with his children. There were no phone calls, no birthday cards, no Christmas presents, nor were there any child support payments. Lonnie Ann was going on with her life, but emotionally, Brad had almost destroyed her. She would gladly have traded his support money for peace of mind. She never knew when Brad might turn up again and try to take her children, or just what revenge he might have in mind. Cynthia received her final divorce decree from Brad on February 9, 1977, and the property settlement agreement was signed on March 6th. Brad offered her $6,000 in cash. He said he was unemployed and his yearly income was only $500, but that his father had agreed to lend him the money to pay Cynthia. He said he planned to go to school in Colorado. Cynthia agreed to the settlement with the proviso that if it turned out that he had lied about his assets, she could have the agreement set aside. Cynthia Marasco had self-esteem going into her marriage with Brad, and she soon found it again when he was finally out of her life. She remarried, this time with great happiness. She never saw Brad again. Part 3. Cheryl. Chapter 17. Brad was a marrying man. There were to be 5 women who became Mrs. Brad Cunningham before he reached his 38th birthday, and for each he was, in the beginning, the perfect man. Except for his second engagement, which was by its very nature expedient and hurried, his courtships were exquisitely planned. He was a prince, the kind of husband many women long for. He was handsome, charismatic, ambitious, and more successful each year. He still had the biceps of a college football player, but he was smoother, more urbane and cosmopolitan. He drove the best cars, he knew the best restaurants, and many women who were intimate with him remember him as a superb lover, attentive and intuitive, patient when he needed to be, wildly passionate later. Moreover, what woman's heart wouldn't go out to a father crying for his lost children? None of Brad's new fiancées ever considered talking with his former wives to learn more about him. Why on earth would they? When Brad described the women who had come before them, he made his ex-wives sound so despicable and immoral that they all wondered how he could have been so stoic and long-suffering. He had stayed in the marriages, he assured them, for the children. His ex-wives had been alcoholic, drug addicts, bisexual, tramps, and lousy mothers. Lauren Kathleen Swanson was a gorgeous, willowy woman, the prettiest of all Brad's women to date. Born in January 1949, she grew up in Redmond, a once rural suburb east of Seattle, and went on to enter the University of Washington in the same freshman class as Cheryl Keaton and Brad Cunningham. Along with Cheryl, Lauren pledged Gamma Phi Beta. Indeed, she and Cheryl were great friends as well as sorority sisters. Lauren majored in education, and when she graduated in 1971, she began a teaching career. Lauren's and Cheryl's friendship grew during their 4 years in college together until they were very close, probably best friends. Lauren knew Dan Olmsted, too. She had met him when he came to pick up Cheryl at the Gamma Phi house. After they all graduated, Cheryl married Dan, and the Olmsteds became part of Lauren's immediate social circle. Although Lauren was still single, she often joined Cheryl and Dan and several other young couples for parties, dinners, and boating trips. Cheryl and Dan had a sailboat they dubbed the Summer Fun, and they and their friends had many great times sailing on Puget Sound. At first, Lauren shared rent with a number of friends from her sorority in one of the big old houses that abound near the university. Later, she had her own apartment on East Lake Avenue a few miles away. She had met Brad Cunningham at the University of Washington and talked with him from time to time since his fraternity, Theta Chi, was next door to the Gamma Phi house. After his sophomore year, Brad didn't live in the fraternity house, of course. He was married to Lonnie Ann and a father and working at Gals Galore. Lauren had always rather liked Brad and found him attractive. Sometimes she wondered how his life had turned out. Then in 1976, 5 years after she graduated, she met Brad again. In the mid-1970s, the Madison Park area of Seattle was in transition. Located on the west shore of Lake Washington, it was crisscrossed with some of Seattle's most expensive streets, but it ran out of high-end real estate as Madison Street headed west up the long hill toward downtown Seattle. There, the neighborhood decayed into time-battered wooden houses, small ethnic grocery stores, and taverns. For decades, it had been a question of which ambiance would prevail. But by the 70s, Madison Park had begun its climb to utter desirability. Singles were flocking to the funky taverns and trendy restaurants that were popping up close by the shores of Lake Washington at the east end of Madison Street. Lauren and Brad ran into each other there one night at the Red Onion, a popular tavern. Balancing drinks, they swiveled through a laughing crowd to find a booth where they could hear each other talk. Brad told her that he was divorcing his second wife, who, he said wryly, had turned out to be a major disappointment. He didn't go into details, but Lauren noted how sad and moody he seemed about his bad luck in love. Like almost all women, Lauren found Brad fascinating. He was even better looking than he had been in college, and he sounded as though he was doing wonderfully well in the business world. She was delighted when he asked her out. They were soon dating steadily, and in a whirlwind courtship, they were engaged just a few months later. Lauren introduced Brad to her circle of friends, and so it was that he met Cheryl and Dan Olmsted for the first time. The two couples rapidly became very good friends and socialized often. Brad was fun, and he was obviously a real mover and shaker in business. After Cheryl Keaton had graduated Phi Beta Kappa from the University of Washington and married Dan Olmsted, he began law school while she took a job doing actuarial work for an insurance firm. She would follow Dan to law school as soon as they could afford it. It was what they had always planned to do. Cheryl had never foreseen anything different in her life. She and Dan would get started in their careers, and at some point they hoped to have a family. In the meantime, Cheryl remained close to her family in Longview and continued to play second mother to her half-sister Susan McNanny. Betty and Bob McNanny had separated and were in the process of divorce. Cheryl adored Bob, she always had, and she was impatient with her mother for leaving him. Susan, who was Bob's only child, was 8 or 9 then, and she was the light of Bob McNanny's life. She stayed in the ranch house in Longview with her father. Susan spent any number of weekends with Cheryl doing girl things. Bob would put her on the train that ran up from Portland, and Cheryl would pick her little sister up at the King Street station in Seattle. In the years that followed, Betty would marry 2 more times, but she would always remain friends with Bob McNanny. And Cheryl would look upon him as a father figure until the day she died. Susan would remember that Cheryl's marriage was happy and comfortable. Dan adored her, and she had really never known any other man. But she married so young, and when she walked out of the church in September 1971, Susan recalled, her sister had cried and cried. Cheryl had a degree in economics. When she worked at Unigard Insurance as a financial analyst, she met another would-be law student who would become one of her most devoted friends, a very tall, dark-haired man named John Burke. Cheryl and John were never more than friends, but she could not have had a better friend. Cheryl and Dan lived in a little studio basement apartment just outside the university district at first, Susan remembered, and later they bought a house on North 45th. But with the wisdom that came when she herself was a grown woman, Susan realized in retrospect that Cheryl had worried that her marriage wasn't strong enough for her to have children. She put off thinking about it, concentrating instead on her career. She and Dan had been sweethearts all through high school and college, and she wanted their marriage to work. "The women in our family don't have a great track record in our marital history," Susan observed. "But Cheryl's marriage to Dan just kind of collapsed on its own. I think Cheryl had doubts from the beginning, but they had dated for so long." Lauren Swanson was amazed at how far Brad had come by the age of 27. He was a real estate developer and had contracts to do projects with well-known Seattle architects and contractors. Lauren loved her job teaching elementary students, but Brad suggested that she might consider becoming involved in his projects, at least part-time. That way, they could work together, and she could learn some of the intricacies of his profession. Lauren was both flattered and excited. By this time, she hoped to become involved in every part of Brad's life. She was in love. Lauren still knew next to nothing about the details of Brad's two divorces. She had never met either Lonnie Ann or Cynthia. She had no reason to. But she did know that Brad was distraught about losing the custody battle for his children. He worried about them continually. He said that Lonnie Ann led a vagabond and often promiscuous lifestyle, and that it wasn't healthy for his children, Lauren said later. He wanted to raise them. They were being exposed to situations that he did not approve of. A lot of men visited, a lot of moving from one location to another. Lauren loved children so much herself, and she felt sorry for Brad. She thought it must have been hell for him to have walked away from his children, to always wonder if they were safe and cared for. It touched her heart to see how much Brad's kids meant to him. It made her love him even more. Their wedding in March of 1977 was very simple. The wedding party included only Lauren's immediate family, Brad's father and his second wife, and Brad's children, Kate and Brent. Kate was almost 7, and Brent was 5. Lonnie Ann had won custody of her children, but she acceded to Brad's requests to have them visit him from time to time. At this point, Brad was still paying his court-ordered child support, and Lonnie Ann wanted to keep things between them as peaceful as possible. Although Lauren and Brad's wedding was a quiet ceremony at her parents' home, the couple threw a wonderful party to celebrate their marriage, and, of course, Cheryl and Dan Olmsted were there. The two couples continued to spend many evenings and most weekends together. Lauren was very happy in the spring of 1977. She and Brad rented a spacious condominium, and she kept her job teaching a third-grade class. She also helped Brad with his construction projects. His career was in high gear, and he was working hard to achieve the success he had always visualized. To their many friends, including Cheryl and Dan, they seemed perfectly matched. Just as he had with Cynthia, Brad took Lauren to Yakima often. They headed over the Snoqualmie Pass to eastern Washington to visit Sanford and Mary. Brad's father had sold the Burian house and moved to Tampico, a tiny hamlet near Yakima. Lauren could see how close Brad and his father were, but she found it a little odd that he had nothing at all to do with his mother. When she asked him about it, he told her his mother had always blamed him for something he couldn't help. "I was an unusually large baby," he said. "I guess that was why she had such a difficult delivery. Later, my mother got some kind of female cancer, and she always blamed me."
"But that wasn't your fault," Lauren said.
Brad shrugged. He really didn't want to talk about his mother. He said that his father had suffered through years of an unhappy marriage with her and hadn't been able to leave until he was grown. The woman Brad described to Lauren sounded like a cruel harridan. Rosemary had made his life miserable when he was a little boy, according to Brad, both with her sharp tongue and with physical punishment. He told Lauren about the day his mother had made him dress up like a girl and clean the house. He had been humiliated, he said, embellishing his story of child abuse. When his father came home and found his son in girl's clothes, he had been outraged, and from that moment on, his mother was virtually banished from Brad's life. His father had told him that he didn't have to pay any attention to her at all. That, Brad explained, was the end of his relationship with his mother as far as he was concerned. Brad also said there were episodes of physical abuse until he had finally grown big enough to defend himself.
When I was 14 or thereabouts, she came after me one day with a vacuum hose, and I took her wrist and bent it back. I told her, "Don't ever come after me again." He didn't tell Lauren about how he and his father had tricked his mother to leave on a vacation. He just said he had sided with his father when he divorced Rosemary. My sisters went with my mother. His sisters, Ethel and Susan, according to Brad, were petty and not very bright. The only member of his mother's family that Brad seemed to care about was his maternal grandfather. He always spoke of Simon Edwards fondly to Lauren. He said he himself was part Colville Indian through his grandfather's lineage. Lauren knew that Brad received small checks periodically from timber sales on the Indian land. Brad didn't tell Lauren, and she had no way of knowing that his mother had remarried. She had gone to college and done rather well. Her name was Rosemary Kinney now, and she was also living in the Yakima area, where she was employed as a caseworker in a social service agency on the Colville Reservation. Knowing how splintered Brad's family was, feeling sad for him that he didn't have Kate and Brent with him all the time, Lauren was thrilled when she discovered she was pregnant in the summer of 1977. Together, she and Brad would build a solid new family to make up for all that he had lost. Brad seemed as happy as she was when she told him about her pregnancy. Brad rented office space in the building on East Lake Avenue in Seattle where architect Felix Campanello was headquartered. He incorporated his newest business. He would always be a firm believer in the sheltering aspects of corporations, and began to teach Lauren how to present his real estate projects at meetings he was too busy to attend. Lauren felt that she basically played only a supportive role. She represented Brad in a couple of meetings, and he was pleased with her, but she was never given any decision-making tasks. That was fine with her. She was a neophyte in real estate development. She would have years to learn the more intricate details of buying land, financing, leveraging, and land use studies. Brad was a walking encyclopedia on everything and anything to do with commercial real estate. One of the projects Lauren participated in was an apartment building surrounded by trees in Kirkland at the far north end of Lake Washington. When it was finished, they named it Sylvan Habitat, and all the apartments were rented immediately. It seemed that everything Brad touched was making money. Lauren knew he was doing well, and she was proud of him. Still, she was almost embarrassed by the way he flaunted his wealth. He bought a more expensive car every time he moved another step up in his career. In only 2 years, Brad owned 12 different vehicles, both cars and trucks. They usually had three at a time. Soon, the only make of car that suited Brad was a Mercedes. He always seemed to have the money to make the payments, but sometimes Lauren wondered what her family and friends thought when she and Brad showed up in yet another higher-ticket car. It was difficult for her to realize that she had been living on the salary of a third-grade teacher only a year earlier, and now she was riding around in plush cars whose motors were so smooth you couldn't even hear them with the windows closed. Although Cynthia Marasco had reported to police a few years earlier that Brad always carried a Colt 38, as far as Lauren knew, the only gun he owned was a hunting rifle. Lauren hated hunting. Much to her revulsion, Brad insisted that she come with him deer hunting that fall on the Colville Indian Reservation. Killing animals was totally against Lauren's nature. But she was in love, and whatever Brad wanted to do, she would go along with. The trip across the Cascade Mountains was glorious as the vine maples glowed coral orange against the sky, and the tamaracks and quaking aspens turned bright gold. It was too bad the purpose of their trip was to look for animals to kill, but Brad told Lauren that everyone in his family hunted. That was certainly true. However, one of the reasons his cousin Gary avoided Brad was the memory of an earlier hunting trip he had taken with him. Brad had shot a deer, but it wasn't a clean kill, and the deer was thrashing around in pain. Gary asked Brad to shoot it again to put it out of its misery. Brad followed the deer into the brush, but Gary didn't hear the crack of a rifle shot. Investigating, he found Brad beating the helpless animal to death with the butt of his rifle. It made Gary sick. He hunted, but he and his family followed the rules of sportsmanship, and they used the game meat for food. "Stop it, Brad!" Gary shouted. "There's a house right there. They can see you." Even that warning didn't work, and Brad continued striking the deer long after it was dead. He was filled with an almost inexplicable rage. He literally broke a chunk of the rifle butt. Lauren didn't know one gun from another, and they all scared her. "Fortunately," she recalled of their trip the autumn after their marriage, "we didn't see any deer." Brad and Lauren continued to see Cheryl and Dan often. If the foursome weren't having dinner at the Olmsteads' apartment, they were probably at the Cunninghams' condo. They all got along. They had fun and laughed a lot. Cheryl had started law school, as she and Dan always planned. Although Dan was already in practice, their budget was a little lean. Brad suggested one night that Cheryl might like to work for him. It seemed like a good solution for everyone. Cheryl and Dan could use the money, and Brad's projects needed someone with Cheryl's legal knowledge and flair for detail. "Yes," Cheryl laughed. "Yes, I want the job." It was only a part-time job. Cheryl still spent most of her time at law school, but they began working together in the fall of 1977, and Cheryl found Brad as bright and charming as a business associate as he was a friend. One night in November of that year, Brad and Lauren gave a pre-Thanksgiving party for a number of friends. Lauren was 5 months pregnant and still working, but Brad had convinced her that she should give up teaching and be a full-time mother. She wouldn't be going back to school after Christmas vacation. Lauren would remember every detail of that party. As she was refilling hors d'oeuvre trays in the kitchen, Dan walked in and shut the door behind him. Lauren turned to him with a smile, and her hands froze on the tray she held. The look on Dan's face was indescribable. It was as if he had come to tell her that someone had died, and in a sense, someone had. Dan had seen what Lauren had not even imagined. He told Lauren that his marriage and hers were in trouble. Although he had tried to deny his suspicions at first, he was convinced that something was going on between Cheryl and Brad, and he thought Lauren should know. Lauren was stunned, staring at him as if he had had too much to drink. But Dan never drank too much. Still, what he was saying couldn't be possible. She was carrying Brad's baby. They were still practically newlyweds. Brad was her husband, and Cheryl was her sorority sister, her friend for so many years. Yes, Cheryl worked with Brad now, but that was only business. If Brad was having an affair, Lauren was sure she would know. There would have been signs, and there had been nothing. The rest of the evening was a blur. Lauren got through the party with a smile frozen on her face, her stomach churning, until the last guests left. As soon as they were alone, she came right out and asked Brad if there was anything between him and Cheryl beyond friendship. Was he having an affair with Cheryl? Brad denied it, half laughing. She was being ridiculous. She was over-emotional because she was pregnant. She was seeing shadows where there were none. Dan was a troublemaker. Brad hugged Lauren, and she tried to feel comfort in his arms, but something had changed. Her world had shifted off its axis and was no longer spinning smoothly. Nothing more was said about Dan's suspicions, but seeds of doubt took root in Lauren's mind. Even as her child kicked beneath her heart, she couldn't forget what Dan had said. She tried to recall if she had seen some intimate look pass between her friend and her husband, and couldn't think of a single instance. It wasn't that Brad didn't have ample freedom to have an affair. Lauren never really knew where he was. His business demanded that he be here, there, and everywhere. That had never bothered her, but now she wondered. Whenever Lauren got the panicky feeling that Dan might be right, she reminded herself that she and Brad were going ahead with their plans to buy their own condominium. Brad wouldn't do that if he were going to leave her, would he? The new condo was much smaller than the one they were living in, but it would be theirs. The mortgage payments would be $400 a month. With Brad's urging, Lauren resigned from her teaching position. She said goodbye to her third graders as Christmas approached. She thanked them for all the presents they brought for her new baby and hugged them. She would miss them, but in 3 months she would have her own baby. It should have been such a happy time for her, but it wasn't. Cheryl and Dan had separated. Dan had been right about that part of his disclosure at the party. He and Cheryl had been having trouble, and it had all come to a head when they went to Longview for Thanksgiving 1977. There, Cheryl told Susan that she and Dan were splitting up. "She took me out for a drive," Susan said. "She told me that she was young, that she'd made a mistake. She even tried to smoke a cigarette. She was so nervous. But she didn't know how to smoke. Cheryl took the train home from Longview that Thanksgiving, and Dan stayed, and he talked with me, too. It was very sad." Cheryl and Dan were both well under 30 when their marriage ended. Cheryl was still on the path to her dream of becoming an attorney, but she had met someone else, someone who absolutely dazzled her, a man so charismatic and seemingly perfect for her that there was no question but that she would go to him. She was completely spellbound, surprised at the depth of her own emotion. She had always been the one who kept her head. She had never felt passion that made her teeth chatter and her skin burn. Now she did. In December, Brad and Lauren were packing boxes in the process of moving out of their rented condominium. Without warning, he turned to her and hit her with paralyzing, stupefying news. He said that everything Dan had told her was true. He was having an affair with Cheryl. "I don't love you anymore," he said. When Lauren didn't say anything, he repeated his words. "Did you hear me? I said I don't love you anymore." As Lauren stood with her arms crossed over her belly, unconsciously protecting her unborn child, Brad told her quite calmly that his relationship with Cheryl was deeply satisfying and that Dan's suspicions had been well-founded. He wanted to be free. He loved Cheryl now. "I'm not moving with you," he said. "You're moving into your new condo alone." Lauren knew that Cheryl had left Dan and was living in an apartment in Madison Park. Her mind raced as she realized that all her fears had come true. Brad was still talking. He told her that he would be moving in with Cheryl, and Lauren, now 6 months pregnant, would be living by herself in the condo that she and Brad had agreed to buy. Brad's instructions were as crisp and deliberate as if he were pointing out the floor plan for an apartment house. It wasn't just hard for Lauren to believe, it was impossible. Couples didn't get married, plan for a new baby and their first home, and get divorced, all in less than a year. Men didn't walk away and leave their wives pregnant and alone. But Brad was going to do just that. He was resolute. This was the way it was going to be. "It was an immediate separation," Lauren recalled, her pain blunted by the passing of years, "in that he basically never moved his belongings from the old condominium to the new condominium in the university district." It was a nightmare for her. It was incomprehensible. "I had given up my teaching contract and was saying goodbye to my third grade class so that when Brad finally notified me that he was going to be moving in with Cheryl, I was basically unemployed, 6 months pregnant, and living in a condominium that cost $400 a month with no way to pay." Had Lauren had any early warning from Brad that their marriage was over, she would never have resigned from her job. Under the teacher's credit union benefits, she would have been eligible for maternity leave with full pay and medical benefits. She would have had a secure job waiting for her return, a career that would help her support her child. Brad knew all that, and yet he had sat back and watched her cut herself off without so much as a word. Worse, he had urged her to resign. "He left me financially stranded," Lauren remembered. "I ended up going to the bank that held the mortgage on the condominium where I was living. Actually, I went in when I was 8 months pregnant and sat down with the vice president and described the situation. I said that I was confident that I would get some sort of settlement from the divorce. Unbelievably, the bank carried me through the divorce and let me stay in the condominium." Over that lonely Christmas of 1977 and into the first months of 1978, Lauren was furious with Cheryl. She was probably angrier at her old friend than she was at the husband who had walked out on her. There was another cruelty that had been inflicted on her. "When Cheryl separated from Dan, and I am confident that she and Brad were then involved in an intimate relationship," Lauren said, "Brad and I were the ones that helped her move into her new apartment and carried her furniture in. Just some memories that are sort of hard to stomach." Lauren hoped never to see or talk to Cheryl again. What good would words or explanations do? What had happened had happened. But a few weeks after Lauren found herself alone, she did see Cheryl again. Even as she still carried his unborn child, Brad had begun divorce proceedings against her, and Cheryl came with Brad to the tiny condo where Lauren now lived. "She was the person to hand me the divorce documents," Lauren said. That was salt in the wound. After seeing Brad's smug face as he watched Cheryl present her with divorce papers, Lauren realized that Brad had really left her, that he wasn't just going through a temporary lapse. He loved Cheryl and not her. That loss was bad enough. The loss of Cheryl's friendship was difficult, too. Her behavior was totally alien to the person Lauren had known for almost a decade. It was as if she were hypnotized. She had never known Cheryl to do or even say an unkind thing before. Lauren couldn't have imagined that the day would come when she would forgive Cheryl, when she would begin to understand why Cheryl had changed so completely from her sorority sister and confidant and dear friend into the woman who had stolen her husband and wrecked her life. There would even come a day when Lauren would feel sorry for Cheryl. Chapter 18. If Lauren assumed that Brad was completely out of her life, that he had abandoned all interest in her, she was woefully mistaken. Brad was not finished with her. She still had things he wanted. Lauren had legal claim to some of his real estate holdings, but more than that, more than anything, she was carrying his child. Brad was still fighting Lonnie Ann to win back Kate and Brent, and he wanted this child, too. He was a child keeper, a man obsessed with owning all the children he had sired. Even before Lauren gave birth, Brad filed for custody of the baby. And although she was hugely pregnant and struggling to survive financially, he began to fight her in one court hearing after another for property he considered rightly his. She met him in court or in their attorney's offices for almost a dozen hearings and depositions. Lauren had naively hired an attorney who would have been perfectly adequate for a simple divorce, but Brad had never had